All right, so you guys said we want to talk about binary stuff. Today's lecture. Yeah, I'll do that and you do that. Okay. And we'll also just do some fun other examples of like loops and conditions and variables and stuff like that, to try to solidify some of the concepts from the Scratch project. Because the Scratch project's really fun, and I think everyone's had a lot of success playing around with it, or you will if you haven't started yet. But we really want to make sure that that's getting converted into understanding about what the fundamental concepts are behind what you're doing. So what are variables, and when do you use them, and why do we care about them? What are loops? What are conditions? How does it all fit together? So without further ado, so guys, I can talk some, let's actually start with some of the, we'll do this in reverse order. I'll talk about some random fun examples or just like get you thinking, and then we'll talk about today's lecture, because a lot of that was very nitty gritty and you just kind of need some big points from it as takeaways. And then, yeah, we'll talk about binary and maybe some other fun things. Okay? So who can tell me what a loop is? Or actually, let's even back up. Who can tell me what a condition is? Sure. So we have an excellent example of a condition is an if statement. So you may not have thought of things as conditional in the past, unless you maybe use like something like conditional formatting in Excel. You might have heard the word, or I don't know, some other random applications. But you use conditions all the time. You're like, okay, I'll go to the movies with you if I finish my homework tonight, right? I mean, all the time you're saying stuff like if this, if that, or rather conditional upon this statement, this thing being true or becoming true, this will happen. Else, if that is not true, this other thing will happen. That's all that's really behind a condition. So I guess I'll probably use this board for now. Okay. So if. So who can tell me an example of a time they used if in a program, or in their Scratch program or something? Yeah.
If such variable is less than 10.
Great. So in Scratch, can you guys all see right if I write right here? Yeah. So in Scratch, we had this puzzle piece that looked roughly like this. And it was if, and then some condition. And then you could put things that you want to be executed if that condition is true, right? And so if, for instance, x is greater than 10, maybe we say x or something like that, or say something else. Who knows? It is very simple. We're not doing anything too sophisticated right here. Do people have questions? This is maybe boring to start off with, but we'll get into something more interesting. So suppose you actually have something a little bit more complicated. Suppose you want to do if this, and then you actually want to check some more things. So what you might see later on, and you might have already used in your Scratch program, is something we call nested ifs. So we can actually make these nested. And what that means is you might actually combine these puzzle pieces. So you might have this if some condition is true, right? Then I actually want to do something a little bit more complicated. I want to check if some other condition is true, right? And then do those things, right? But if they're not both true, then that's not what I want to do. And in fact, we could think of making this even more concise. How can we do that? Great, so we can say and, which is a logical operator, which we'll talk more about in future sections and classes and stuff if you're not familiar with it. But it actually makes sense. We could say something like, if something is true and something else is true, make this all one puzzle piece and go from there, right? So then the question is, why would we ever combine if statements in this way? Actually, does everybody follow this idea here? Right? Like, say we were talking about points on a graph, and we were like, we only want to do this operation if we're in the first quadrant. So both our x and y are positive. So we might say something like x is greater than 0 and y is greater than 0. If x is less than 0 but y is greater than 0, we're not going to go do this. And any other combination of one of them being false or both of them being false, we won't do this. Does that make sense? Okay. So then can anybody think of an example where you'd actually want to put one if statement inside of another if statement? What's a slightly more complicated version of this puzzle piece? Yeah. Sure. So that's one option. This may not be the best style for how to write this, but it could be conceptually how you handle this case, where maybe you want to say, okay, if this big condition is true, then let's look at a bunch of different things, which is actually another way. A simpler version might be something like, actually, I'll leave that. Whatever. I'll erase it. Might be to think back to a slightly more complicated puzzle piece, which is, you have this if, whatever, same as before, then you might actually have, let's see if I can draw it, an if else in here. That's terrible. Or even an if else if. So this might just say else here. And this is just if some other condition, right? Right. So that's completely the right idea. When we get to binary search, we'll get to some other ways of thinking. So this is one way of thinking about binary search, I suppose, or splitting a problem continuously in half. But the only issue there is that you'd have to continue nesting these ifs, so there is actually a slightly more elegant solution, but we won't worry about that for now. But yeah, it's the right thought process. So we might say, like, if, I don't know, the sky is blue or something like that, and I don't know, if there are birds chirping, then print that it's spring. But if the sky is blue, and the birds are not chirping, then print it's winter or something like that, or it's summer. I don't know. It's a silly example, but you'll do more complicated things. Do people have questions on this so far? All right. So that's something you'll see later. It's just sort of a preview into more complicated forms of conditions. But pretty straightforward, I guess. Okay. And you would put something else in here. But remember the stylistic advantage to doing, if you just have two ifs inside of each other, you can probably combine them into being if this and this. Okay? Cool. What if you actually, like, here's a question for you guys. What if you cared that you just didn't want to be in the third quadrant. You didn't want both things to be negative. How would you change that? So, like, say you were going to do something, say you were going to color your point, right? And this case is saying, okay, we're only going to color this point if it's over here, right? And I'm saying we want to color it if it's there, there, or there. How would you do it? Yeah. So if what are everywhere? I think you're thinking along the right track. So what conditions would you be writing over here? There are a few ways of doing it. You can think about different ways of doing it. So you can use an OR. We'll get to that. Was that what you were going to say? Or there are a few ways of doing it. You could also say, okay, if x is greater than 0 and y is greater than 0, that covers this quadrant. Or x is less than 0 but y is greater than 0, that covers this one. Or greater than and less than. You can make it a nice observation, which one of you or two of you may have made, which is what? You don't have to write all of that out. So what am I going to write? So I say if not, so this is a fun fact for the day, the bang operator, the exclamation mark means not. Okay, so if not what? Fantastic. So we sort of flip the problem. We're not thinking about it as combining these three. We're just say, okay, we don't want them both to be negative, right? So if all right, so if x is less than 0 and y is less than 0, we're in here. So in all cases where that's not true, we want to do this condition, right? So we're going to evaluate this whole thing, and we'll be doing, and then we'll be coloring the point or whatever this action is anytime in these three, or anytime that we're not in this one. Questions? What's another way you could do it? Yeah. Huh? Awesome. So we could just change this to be an or. Does that make sense? So if either x is greater than 0 or y is greater than 0, that means they're not both greater than 0. That means they're either both greater than 0 or at least one of them is greater than 0, as in they're not both negative, then you can enter the if statement and execute it. Which actually brings up a good point, or a good, I don't know. We've essentially understood now what logical and logical or do, but let's formalize that for a second while we're at it. So, actually that's confusing to continue to use x and y, maybe. So we'll just say thing one, and thing two, they can be anything, whatever. I mean, I guess they're Boolean, they're true or false, but. Let's think about what it means to and two things together and or two things together. So if we have two, and some of you may have seen this is called a truth table. So if we have two true things and we and them together, what do we get? True. And what do I mean when I say we and them together? Well, that's exactly what we were doing here. When this said and, we were saying, well, if this is true and this is true, then this whole thing must be true, right? And when I say this whole thing must be true, that's anding them together, right? Do people get that? Okay. So if we and true and false together, what do we get? False. Because this is true and, oh wait, this is not true. So the and of them is not true. Okay? So false and true is false. False and false. False. So the and of two things is only true when they're both true. Which is exactly what you told me when you were just doing condition stuff and just telling me in plain English. It's just plain English. That's all it is. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, or is also plain English, essentially. And it's, if this is true or this is true, then the or of them together must be true. If this is true, or rather, if one is true or the other is true, or both, yeah, there's XOR and other things, so but we're not going to get into those right now. Later, we'll do that. So if either or is true, then the or of them together is true. False and true, or false or true? True. False or false? False. All right. And this is really just a slightly more complicated way of writing down exactly what you already knew and told me. But if you see that, don't be intimidated by it. And if you get confused, you can think back to it. Okay? So that's called a truth table. All right. Let's see. Need an eraser. Actually, maybe we'll move over here. So in addition to conditions, we have what other kinds of programming constructs do we have? Functions. All right. We won't get into those yet, but we'll write them down for helpfulness later. So we have functions. We have conditions. We have statements, which are what? What's an example of a statement? Huh? Sure, sky equals blue, x equals 10, x plus plus, or perhaps print hello, say hello, whatever. Those are all statements. How about something else? What other kind of things have you seen? Anything. All right, well, let's, huh? Okay, loops, sure. So let's think about an example where we want to print the squares of just the first couple integers after zero. So we want to print 1 squared, 2 squared, 3 squared, 4 squared, and 5 squared. Okay? And how do we do that? Well, what's the most simple way you would do that? How would you print the first number? Or how would you do the first part of output of your program? Yeah. Okay, so that's probably not what you would first think if you'd never programmed, but yes, that is eventually what we will get to. So if you had never programmed and you're just doing the most simple thing you could ever do, you'd probably just say print either 1 squared if it was implemented or 1 times 1, right? Then you'd do that same thing again, and you'd say the next line of your program would read print 2 times 2. Then you'd say the same thing all the way down to print 5 times 5, which is not so bad, right? You've only written a couple lines of code, right? You wrote one line for the 3 and one line for the 4, so you wrote 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines, whatever, no big deal. You write code that's thousands of lines long eventually. But it's probably not the easiest way to do this, especially if I said, oh, wait, I don't care about just going up to 5 squared. I want to see them all print out up to, like, I don't know, 200 squared, okay? How fun is this going to be to write? Well, it's probably not going to be that fun. There's copy, paste, and whatever else, but probably not that fun. So how can we do this better? And somebody already mentioned that we have these things called loops. So how would we do this with a loop? And is this, like, way too small? Can you guys read this? No? Okay. It's too small. So we have something called a loop. So what are we going to do? What are we looping over? Like, what is this repeated action? If you could just tell me in English what we're going to do. Yeah.
It's like 4 numbers, 1, 2, 5.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the numbers starting at 1 and ending at some number, in this case 5, we're going to print out that number times itself, right? Pretty straightforward. So we want to do the same thing. So let's say, I don't know, what kind of loops have we seen? Like, what actual words? Forever. Okay. Do we want to put any condition on this? Forever. We'll just go forever. Okay. So forever, well, we need to start with some variable, right? So maybe we'll initialize. This is called initialization of a variable. Myself some more space. So we'll just say some variable x equals what? Where are we going to start x at going into this loop? 1. Okay, great. Okay. Now what are we going to do? We get into this loop, and so basically we're going to get some chunk of code that we're going to execute, and then we're going to come back up to here and execute the code again, and execute it again, and again, and again. Okay? So what's the first step? What do we want to do? We have this number 1. Yeah. All right, so we're going to do 1 times 1. We're not actually even going to write 1 times 1. Yeah, I think you just said it. X times X. So X times X. And we actually, so we're just going to print this, right? Okay. And Let's see, what else do we want to do? Do we need anything else in the loop? Yeah. Awesome. So increasing x by 1, the common programming way of doing that is just plus plus, depending on what language you're in. That just means the same thing as what? If I were to write this as x equals something, what would it be? Yeah. X plus 1. X equals x plus 1 is the same thing as x plus plus, but people like to not type a lot, so it's x plus plus. Do you have a question? Fantastic. So that's a great point. So the point he made was, when is this going to stop, right? So this brings up a good bug that you guys may be writing into programs that you do in the future. Not probably programs that are quite as simple as this, because you'll immediately realize it, but more involved things where you have corner cases and whatever else. What have we gotten ourselves into here? What we've gotten ourselves into is what we call an infinite loop, right? Which is a name that makes sense. This is just going to keep running forever, because we have forever, and we print the number, we increment the number, we go back, we print it, or print the square of it, increment, go back, print the square. When is this going to end? Never, right? It's just going to keep running, and the person operating their computer is not going to be able to do anything else in that window, because the program is just running forever, constantly spitting out numbers. It's never going to end. So what was your suggestion? Right. So forever until x is greater than 5. So this condition will be checked every time we get up to the top of the loop. So we print 1 times 1, increment x to be 2, get up there, print 2 times 2, et cetera, increment, and continue. Okay? Huh? Okay. So do you guys know what scratch box would you use for this variable stuff? For this incrementing? This is written in like a combination of Scratch and C right now. Probably confusing. Yeah, change x by 1, right? And those are the orange variable building blocks, right? And the print would be what? Say. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, totally. So that in this, I think an example as simple as this, that choice is probably yours, and I don't think I would have a strong opinion either way. They both make sense to me. I think later on we'll come across two different kinds of loops. One is while, and one is the for loop. And we actually are sort of hinting at this here. The while loop in C is basically like while some condition is true, and it's as simple as that. And the for loop is set some initialization, while this is true, do this, and then increment my variable, okay? And so that seems to actually be a better loop to be using here, and you'd be able to combine that all into the condition, all into like the for loop original thing. You always want to clean up your code. You always want to make it as stylistically nice as possible and as readable as possible, especially because you're training yourself for writing code that eventually other people would want to read. And in fact, we'll be reading it every week, so we really like it if you satisfy it. Yeah.
So if you were to use incrementing before you print, would you have to change anything else in this loop?
Well, you'd want to start with x equals 0.
Sure. So that's one place. Anything else you would need to change?
So the question for anybody watching it is there anything else that you would have to change besides the x equals 0 if we were to put the x plus plus before the print? So we hear x greater than 4, so why? Can you explain that? Okay, so what the answer was here was basically like, we're going to start with x equals 0, and we originally said forever while x is greater than 5. But what's wrong with that? Well, we'll print. So supposing we have x plus plus here and not there, what we'll do is we'll print 1 squared, come back and check the condition, print 2 squared, come back and check the condition, it's still not greater than 5, 3 squared, come back and check the condition, 4 squared, come back and check the condition. 5 squared, come back and check the condition. Wait, I've now gotten confused.
So when you get 5 squared.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Great. Since we have greater than, you could do greater than or equal. 5 squared, then 6 squared. And then 6 would be greater. Yeah, I mean, you could also just say greater than or equal to 5.
So within loops, they don't actually check the condition of the loop each time the loop is executed. Only when the loop, it's only when the content of the loop is fully executed, then it checks the condition again. Or, because I mean, technically it would be 5, and then you print x and x, but if it checked it when x is 5, then you wouldn't get the 5 square.
Yeah, so often we get this off by one error where we can't remember which way we're supposed to be setting up our loop. And if you just step through, what you'll see is basically you always start with whatever the top of the loop is and check that condition before you ever enter the loop.
And
you don't check it ever during the loop. You do the whole loop, then you go back and check the condition. So here what we were doing here was basically like we'd printed the number we wanted at that step, and then we were setting up for the next step. So we were going to catch ourselves when we got up to here and never enter. But we were off by one, and here we would actually enter and then increment, enter, print, and increment, and then have printed one too many.
So just to answer your question earlier, which one is stylistically better, it depends on, according to you, which one sounds more natural. Do you want to say, I want to continue this loop until x is greater than 5, or until x is greater or equal to 5?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think here, I mean, it's a matter of personal preference. There will be more obvious times later when one it seems stylistically better, or when your TF will point out that one was stylistically better. I think most of these things, you sort of have to make the mistake once or twice to actually pick up on the subtleties of style, and it's hard to give a blanket rule as to what you should do. Okay, so for a little while, I'll talk about, if there are no more questions, I'll talk about lecture from today and sort of what I think the big takeaways are. And then if you have like very specific questions, you can either ask them to me now and I'll try to answer them, or you can ask them in office hours if they come from today's lecture. So, do you have the lecture notes? Can you possibly pull those up?
Huh?
Can you pull up the lecture notes? They should be online. Okay, so before I move on, are there any questions on the stuff we've covered so far? The lecture notes,
Or slides?
Slides. All right, so I'll try to go sort of slide by slide-ish, just for your own clarity. So if you have those, you can pull those out. Yeah, I'll just look at them. We don't need to project them, probably. You can set that up if you feel like it, but. So, I think sort of what David's point was today was sort of to go through the basic parts of a C program and then to use his specific example of printf to sort of lead into some sort of specifics of printing in your programs and stuff like that. Now, whether you don't need to ever remember all the different like formatting stuff and how you would print this with the perfect number of spaces and everything else, because that's always in a book or online, you can always look it up. What you really want are the big takeaways. So, I think the first big takeaway from lecture today, and I may go slightly off in terms of order because I wasn't the one lecturing, but I'll do it again. So the first big takeaway is that you have these things called libraries. And basically, when we have these languages like C and things like that, not everything was built into the language at the time it was written and implemented. And so libraries are basically people's add-ons to, and you could actually write your own libraries, people's add-ons to sort of what you can build with C. And they're basically a set of functions or chunks of code that people have written and put in specific files in specific places that either are online or you can download them or we have them on our CS50 account and your program can be looking at them. And their implementations of functions like printf is one of those, and get integer, where you get stuff from the user, is another one, which he mentioned at the very end of class, and things like that. All these chunks of code, which somebody else has let you access. And so what you need to tell your program is, where do I access this particular code that I want to be using in my program. And so that's something called pound include. And then what he has here is pound include standard io.h. And don't worry about exactly sort of the syntax here. I promise you'll make mistakes with the syntax in terms of like whether this should be brackets or whether it should be quotes, stuff like that. We'll get into that minutia later. But the basic idea is you want to tell your program, there's some library, and I'm going to include it. I'm going to tell you where it is, tell you the program where it is. And it's called standard io.h. And there are functions in there that I'm going to want to use. One of those functions is printf, but there are many functions in there. Does that make sense? And that's just because we don't want to write printf ourselves again, because we're lazy and that would be enough work that we just don't care to do it. Okay? The next thing he showed, and let's actually... Okay, the next thing he showed was he wrote int main, and then he wrote some stuff in here, and then some brackets, and then some more stuff in here. Okay, so this is like a basic C program has, and this is no different than any other function really, but a function called main. Okay, so this is the function name. This is probably not legible at all. This is the function name. The function is named main. This is the function return type, meaning at the end of executing this function, right, at the end of the time that this program runs this function, when it gets to this last curly brace, it's going to return some integer, meaning it's going to basically spit up some integer. And when you have functions within functions, it just goes up sort of to the next level. It returns to wherever that function was called from. All of this doesn't have to make sense right now. We'll get into it a lot more later. But for the purposes of main, since main in C is sort of this reserved function, this function that says, this is where I'm going to start executing my program when I run it. This is always going to return usually a 0 or a 1, which is indicative of whether or not the program succeeded in executing or failed in executing. That's mostly a fun fact for now. You really don't need to know it for the purposes of this class right now. Okay. On stuff I've said so far, are there questions? I'm getting confused looks. Let me know if you have questions, because I didn't really understand this at all the first time I saw it. You'll see it lots more times, so it's okay if you do have questions and you don't feel like asking them right now. The two things that are in here in main right now, just don't even worry about them. All they're for is basically allowing you to get stuff from the user, allowing the user to type the name of your program, and then more stuff. Like, how many of you guys have used Pine? So one person. So Pine is an email program, and you can run Pine, and then you can put more arguments after it. So you can write something like Pine if you just want to open the program, or if you're in a rush, you can write something like Pine K Pfeiffer, or somebody's username. And what that's going to do is it's going to open Pine. You're going to be open to an email that you're composing to me. Okay? Now that's irrelevant, and who cares about Pine for now? But the point is, the user entered this other thing besides just the program's name, and the program was written to accept that via these things in here, which basically one of them is going to give you the actual words that they wrote, and one of them is going to give you how many words they wrote, so you know what you're looking at. But just don't worry about it. You'll use all that stuff later, but for now, you can just put this. You can actually, if you're writing your program, not even put anything in here, and you'll be totally fine. Okay? You can just use open parenthesis, close parenthesis, and put nothing there. Okay? But this brings up a good sort of discussion of what does a lot of the syntax stuff mean? What is a function? Let's not get into too much about what a function is right now, because you got to get some of the other basics down first. But in case you're interested, what a function is basically in terms of what you write, it's a function name, a function return type, and some what we call arguments or parameters. Okay? And when you get to when your program gets to executing a function, what it's going to do is it's going to set aside some space to work on. And everything you do within that function, right? Like say you say, I want some integer x. Oops, that was wet. Gross. Give me int x and set x equal to 5. Okay? Then what's happening over here is the program setting aside some space, which some people refer to as like the scratch pad, or they refer to it as a stack frame or whatever. Don't worry about what it's called for now. And what we're saying is we want some chunk of memory, x, and it can hold an integer, okay? And we're going to actually put the number 5 in there, okay? And later we can go manipulate it. We might say, on the next line, we might say x plus plus. And then this 5 would be erased, and you would get a 6 here. Okay? This is all just kind of like fun fact for now and sort of trying to fill in some holes, but there's a lot to learn from different angles, and you don't need to really worry about this for now. But that's sort of one way of thinking about things. And then when you're actually done with this function, when you've gotten to the end of this curly brace, right, this whole thing is actually thrown out. Okay? And you return back to the thing above it whatever sort of return type was requested. Okay? So if we think, let's think about maybe a slightly better example, although we are sort of getting ahead of ourselves. Let's think about, we have some function, and we want it to sum up two numbers, okay? So we're going to call it sum. All right, that's the function's name. And the thing is, we want that function to know about the two numbers we want to sum, okay? So we're going to say it's going to get an integer, which we'll call A, and it's going to get an integer, which we'll call B. Okay. And here we're going to define the function, okay? We're going to say, what does this function do when we use it, essentially? And what it's going to do is A plus B, okay? But we actually want somebody to know about that. We want somebody to be able to use that. And so we're going to say return A plus B, okay? And you may all be very confused right now, but let's look back to what he talked about in lecture, which was this very basic example of int main, some stuff which you don't need to worry about, open brackets, printf. He said, hello world, or hello, or something like that. Okay? So the clarification I'd like to make here is that when we're talking about functions, which we really shouldn't even be talking about right now anyways, but when we're talking about functions, there's one thing called the definition and declaration of the function, where we actually say, if this function sum is ever used, this is what we want it to do, A plus B, and return, give that back to whoever used it. Okay? There's another thing, which is actually using the function, right? So printf has a declaration like this, which tells it what to do. Its definition might be like output whatever I get as my argument. See, here we're just giving it an argument. Whatever I get as my argument, output that to the screen. All right? So let's use sum to see if we sort of understand what this is all about. So I'll tighten this up. So this is our definition of sum. Return A plus B. All right, so now I have my program. Okay. And let's say I have two numbers, int x and int y. And let's say actually this one equals 5 and this one equals 6, and I'm running out of room. Oops. So let's just suppose this comes down onto the next screen here. You guys see both of them right now? Yeah. So what would I do? Well, I would actually say, okay, I want to, what's called calling the function. I want to use the function sum. And I want to give it x and y. Or rather, I could even be more simple and straightforward and just say, find me the sum of 5 and 6. Okay? And let's store that in some other variable, a, and just say a equals the sum of 5 and 6. And then I could just say print a. All right? So what's going to happen? So we enter our program because we start at main. We give ourselves some variables, which in this example we don't even need to do. And we say, okay, call this function sum, which we've just defined as taking two variables, adding them together, and giving them back to whoever used it. So right here, this whole statement gets executed. This whole thing gets executed. And what sum do we get back? It's good. And 11 is put into A, and then we print A. Okay. So let's get back to the lecture notes, because really, if you don't understand anything from all of this, it's totally fine. I just wanted to give a little bit of background to what he started talking about. He started getting into a lot of nitty-gritty about printf and formatting stuff. So you couldn't actually say print A here. And why is that? Well, the computer can't distinguish, if you just say print A, it can't distinguish between whether or not you want to print the letter A or whether you want to print whatever variable is actually in A, like whatever number is in the variable A. Okay? So you need to give it basically special instructions to do that. So that is what we called format string. So this little percent sign, D, okay, comma, A, would actually print what you wanted. So what all this says is I want to print, like, it doesn't really matter what, like, if you remember that it's D or F or whatever else, you can always look that up. D happens to be for printing numbers, and it's nice for printing integers. Yeah, D for decimal, as opposed to like a character, and really as opposed to other kinds of numbers, but whatever. So this percent is like, hey, computer, I don't actually want you to print the letter D. I want to let you know that some number is coming, okay? And print that number. Now, what number that is actually held in this variable, okay? Questions? No? So percent D says basically, in this space, or rather, like, so say I had said printf hello, like, my number is percent D, is something you could write. Percent D just says leave a space and throw in whatever variable you see after the comma. Okay? So then you need the comma and you need the actual variable. And since this was 11 when we last checked, this will print 11 right here. And you'll never see the percent D print. A lot of this stuff you can just play with and figure out, because if you try this, you'll see what happens. If you try it wrong, you'll see what happens, stuff like that. And so you could actually say, what if you wanted to say, like, hello, my name is, and then you actually had a variable with your name in it, okay? What you would do is you would say percent S, because that stands for string. And so you actually want a string to print out when you have your name. A string is just a bunch of characters, so like K-A-T-I-E would be a string. the characters K, A, T, I, and E. Okay? And it'd be basically the same thing as this, only when we got to this, we'd have comma, and then we'd have whatever your variable name was. So say it was just a name or something like that. I mean, you could have named your variable anything. Confused. Somebody's clear, but somebody else is confused. So let's think of a program where this actually we might actually use this. So let's say you wrote a game, right? And somebody's playing your game, and they want to enter the name that they want to be playing the game as, some username, whatever. So what you might do is you might say, pound include whatever you need to include, whatever libraries you're going to be using functions from. Then you might say something like int main. And then you might say, OK, I want a name from the user, all right? So you might say something like, I don't know, whatever function you have. Maybe you wrote a function to say get input from user. So you called your function get input. This was somewhere else. Or you're using it from somebody's library. Don't worry about that for now. But you get input. And functions always have these parentheses come after them, regardless of whether you actually have any arguments in here, right? OK? Like, for instance, printf takes arguments. You got to give it some quote, something quote. OK? And you have the option of giving it variables after that. But here, our get input doesn't need any arguments because it just knows, OK, go ask the user for input. OK? It'll become more clear. So get input. So I ask the user for input. They type in their name and press enter. OK? Now, where is that name? Well, get input probably returned it to me here in main. And I probably have it in main, but it's just, if I don't store it somewhere, I'm not going to remember what it is. This main part of the program is going to have no idea what this name was if they didn't store it in a variable. So here we come back to variable use. So let's say we declared some variable, which is going to be a string, right? And what do we want to call our variable? Anything. What? We could call it X. We could call it name. Let's just call it, like, username. OK? And so we'll say then user name equals get input. And so whatever you get back from get input will be stored in username. All right? And then let's say we want to print it out to them just to make sure they typed it in right and whatever and they were happy with it. We'll print it back to them. So what are we going to write to print it back to them? Who can tell me? Yeah. So printf, open parenthesis, %s, comma, username. All right, and so this username is going to get substituted in here for this %s, and what's going to get printed is their name. Now, what we've seen a couple times in class is where we print something like hello or a name or whatever else, and then all of a sudden the prompt comes right after it. Why is that? Like you might get like hello, your program executes, and you might get like hello, and then you might get like whatever your prompt says. I don't know. What's happening there? Your program did not output this part, yeah? Exactly. So we have to tell the program everything we want it to do. So if we want it to create a new line, or rather go on to the next line, after this thing is printed, we better tell it. So how do we tell it that we want a new line? Well, and I always get this backwards, but we say something like that. All right? Y/n, why something so arcane? Well, that's just saying, if we had actually said new line or something like that, like let's suppose we were writing C. If we had actually let somebody print, like somebody just use new line to signify I want a new line, then they would never be able to write the letters new line. and actually have new line print out to the screen. Does that make sense? As opposed to actually returning? That was not well articulated, but basically this is this slash, and he got into this a little bit today, is what's called an escape character. And it basically says, don't treat me as something you should print. Don't print a slash. Rather, look at whatever's next and print whatever that signifies. So slash n signifies print a new line. Okay? And this is just another one of these nitty-gritty details that you sort of pick up as you go, but it's not anything, it's not rocket science per se, it's just how it's done. Okay? And there are a bunch of different escape characters. He went over a few of them. Slash C is a carriage return where you just go to the beginning of the line. I don't really know. That's, huh? What's slash R? Oh, sorry. Slash R is carriage return. Thank you. Okay. More questions about printf. That's pretty much it on printf.
Can you give an example of showing like they come more than one?
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. So what if they had? What if we had two users and we had variables username 1 and username 2 and we'd done this whole deal and we had both of them? What would we do? Well, yeah, actually, maybe I'll use a new board. They're actually not. So if we had two, if we had username 1 and username 2, and they'd both been filled in, both variables had been initialized with names, how would we print both names? Like, let's say we want to print name 1 and name 2, like the word and in between them. What would we do? Printf, somebody tell me. Yep, %s, so that's going to get us one of the names. Sure, so we're going to need to hold another space for the other name. And then if you want to like have any space in between them, make sure you leave a space. Or you might want the word and, or you might want whatever else. You can just put any English in there. And then what? We close the quotes. And what do? We do comma. What do I write? Yep, username 1. Comma, username 2. Okay. What if I wanted to reverse the names? What if that printed Katie and Yao, but I really wanted to print Yao and Katie? Yeah, just switch the variables here, because these just get substituted in order. That one goes there, and that one goes there. If we wanted to reverse it, we could just substitute where they appear in this list. And again, as soon as you sit down to a computer and play with that, you'll see all of that.
It can be a mixture of strings and numbers. So you could have person S, person D, person C, yeah. And then you might input something like Katie, 3, the letter like 5, F.
Yeah.
So something like that. So you can, but everything follows in order. Does that make sense?
Good. Okay. So the one other thing he talked about, and I'll actually let Yao talk about this, but the one other thing he talked about was sort of mod and integer division and stuff like that. So that's what we'll do next. Are there questions on stuff we've covered so far? I know we covered a lot with sort of like what is a function, what are the parts of a function. There will be a whole week or so devoted to this later, and we'll have a whole section on it, and we'll go over it a lot, but this is sort of a sneak preview of sorts. Do people have questions on the printf and how printf works? There's lots of stuff you can do to like format your print string all sorts of ways, like make it all line up nicely together and space it out in some way. All that stuff, just look up in a book. None of us know it off the top of our heads. You don't need to either. So, cool. I'm gonna take over.
Sure. Okay, so can I erase this now?
Yep.
Thanks. Okay, so I'm sure you can. Does someone have a question about binary before? Because I'm going to cover that next.
I think that was a question, yeah. One's complement, two's complement.
Sure. Is that? Yeah. Okay. So, does everyone know how binary with positive integers work?
Yeah.
Like, can you convert a binary into, let's just get try. So convert, how would you convert this into base 10? Yeah. So right now this is base 2. What is it in base 10?
Base 10 being the normal number.
Right, the normal number, decimals. What? Sorry.
So if you were to read it, it would definitely be that.
Right.
If you were to assume this number was in base 10.
Well, so for example, okay, sorry, so these ones don't mean, like, one here doesn't mean like 100, it means 4 actually, because it's base 2. So for example, 1, 1, that's not saying 11, that's actually saying 2 to the first plus 2 to the zeros, which gives you 3. Does anyone need, no. That makes, okay. So what about this one? 101, 101 in base 2. Hmm? How did you do it? Okay, so this is times 1, times 2, right. Excellent, so these are the basis of, these are the powers of 2, right? So if you just add up everything that has a 1 in it, so it's 1 plus 4 plus 8 plus 32, and yep, that does indeed give you 45. Everyone is okay with this. Okay, how about the other way? How would you convert, say, 110 in base? So when I write this subscript, it means the base. So base 10 is our normal decimal, DEC, you know, the prefix is 10. So 110 in base 10, what is that in base 2? How would you do that? Mm-hmm. Wait, is this? Sorry, am I covering things that everyone already knows? Who doesn't know how to convert things from decimal to binary? Oh, okay. So everyone is good with this then. Excellent. Sorry for Okay. Okay, so let's talk about representation on the computer then. So that's how we represent positive integers, right? So in order to get a negative integer, does anyone remember what 1's complement is? Right. So to give you an example, suppose everything is, so suppose we're working with 8-bit numbers. This means every number is represented with 8 bits. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And someone give me a random number. Just read out zeros and ones, please. Okay, 0, 0, 0. Huh? Right, sorry, this is still base 2. Okay, so 0, 0, 0, 1. Well, it doesn't matter, right? Okay. Okay, so if we take the complement, the 1's complement of this number, so this number is actually 0, 2, 4, 0, 16. So this is actually 22. I hope I got the math right. So if we take the complement of every single bit, by that I mean flip every 0 into a 1, flip every 1 into a 0, we get 1, 1, 1, 0, 1. 001. Everyone following? So this number in our 1's complement representation does not stand for 1, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. It does not stand for what you think it is normally, which is 128 plus 64 plus 32 plus 8 plus 1. This, in our representation, will actually mean negative 32. Oh, sorry, 22. I was reading the wrong. Thank you. Negative 22. So how can you tell? So if I just give you a number and tell you that this is in one's complement representation, say this number, how would you know if it's supposed to be this number or negative 22? Exactly. So the convention with one's complement is that if it leads with a zero, so we isolate the first bit. If it's a zero, we treat it like a plus sign. If it's one, we treat it like a negative sign. And if it's plus sign, we do whatever we normally do, convert 10110 in the normal way into 22. However, if we start with a one, we know that this is actually the complement of a positive number and it's actually the negative of it, which means we take the complement of what follows it, get the decimal representation, and add the negative sign in front of it. If that's confusing you, let me give you an example. So if we have 110100121, right? And we want to see what number this is. We look at the first digit. It's a 1, which means this is negative. So you're not treating it normally. So what do you do with the rest? Good. So this one is a special one, which means it's, say, it's negative. We flip the bits of the rest. We get 0100110. And convert this into decimal, we get 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So this is 38. Right, so this is 38, so we know that this is negative 38. Is everyone following this? Does anyone have any questions? Go ahead. Excellent question. Right. So because we have limited all the positive numbers to start with a zero, right? What's the biggest positive number you can represent? Right, so you will put every, tell me the binary. Right, so, so the biggest number you can represent with 8 bits in one's complement is 0, that signifies that it's positive, 1111111, and I think this is 127. Similarly, what's the biggest number you can, what's the smallest negative number you can represent in this representation? Well, we know the first digit is 1, right? Good. Does everyone see why it's all ones? All zeros. Does everyone see why it's all zeros? Good. So, okay. So we flip everything. We get the 7 1. So this is negative 127, right? So how many numbers is this from 127 to negative 127? So there are 255 numbers we can represent. However, theoretically, how many numbers we can represent with 8 bits? What I'm asking is, given 8 bits, how many different combinations of zeros and ones are there? Hmm? 256? Yep, that's right. Does everyone see why it's 256? Good. So with 8 bits, there are, actually let me say it this. With n bits, there are 2 to the n different combinations of ones and zeros. So what this is saying is that if we use ones complement, we can represent one number fewer than the theoretical maximum. Why is that? Where is a missing number, or where is a duplicate? Sorry, what? Exactly. Does everyone see the two representations of zero? Well, I'll write this. So I'm moving horizontally, erasing as I go. Okay, so the one way is if we think of zero as positive, we get 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, right? So this is like the positive zero. And if we say, okay, let's try the negative one, then 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. We know that this is negative, we flip the rest, we get zeros. So this is like our negative zero, right? Sorry. Go ahead.
It seemed like Professor McGillum was saying that you lost like half your, you lost the entire power of two. You use the base one or base two. That is base two for the
one's complement? We'll get to 2's complement next, but I think what he means is that as far as positive number goes, normally with 8 bits, we can go from 0 to 255, but because now we have to reserve the first bit as the sign bit, we can only use 7 bits to do the number, so we can do from 0 to 127, and that's halved. I believe that's what he means. So everyone's clear, right? So the thing with computer science is that we like to be very frugal. We like to conserve. We don't like redundancy. So this is why 2's complement was invented. So let me get a different board. So everyone's good on one's complement, no questions. Okay, so let me just, 2's complement. Okay, so the algorithm to do 2's complement is that one, you flip all the bits, sorry, I meant to generate it to get a negative number. So to get negative n, one, you flip all the bits and n, and 2, you add 1 to the result. Does that sound familiar to everyone? Anyone? Well, we'll see an example. So, let's see. So suppose we have, let's say, the number 7. And we're still in 8 bits. So what's 7 in binary with 8 bits? Right. So 7 is 1 plus 2 plus 4, so you now have zeros on the last, I mean, 1s on the last 3 digits. So we have 5 zeros and 3 ones, right? So this is 7. And the first thing we do is we flip all the bits and ends to get negative 7. So becomes 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. And then next, we add 1 to it. So negative 7 would be 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1. So, sorry, what's your question? Right. Okay, good point. Right. So just like earlier when I asked, how would you tell whether in one's complement whether this is a positive number or negative number, what was the thing you look for? Right. Same thing with two's complement. So when you look at 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, you look at the first bit again, it's a 1, right? Well, okay, so we don't really sacrifice it. Let me see if I still have the other board. Okay. Right. So we're not really sacrificing it. Or if by sacrificing you mean we cannot represent as many positive numbers as before, yes, that is correct, right? But our overall representational power, so as I say, here we get 255 numbers out of 256. So in one's complement, we're only sacrificing like one possibility. Does that make sense? So as we will see, with two's complement, we will be able to represent 256 numbers, and that's a maximum we can do with 8 bits, right? Yes, that's for one more number, but I can get back to you on why one number is so important, but I think the idea is that less redundancy and it just makes things simpler. Right. Okay. So everyone sees how we can go from positive number to negative number, right? So I propose a question. Does everyone still need the ones complement? Or actually, let me move on to this board. Okay. So. So suppose I give you a number 110110001. And I ask you, okay, so I'm telling you this is a 2's complement. So the question is, what is this number? How would you do it? Okay, let's try that. So we're just reversing the two steps we had earlier, right? So given this, we have 1 1 0 1 1 0 0 0. And remember how we don't really use the first bit. This first bit saying it's a negative number. We turn this back into its original decimal representation. So this is 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. So this is 64 plus 24, which gives you 88. So we can conclude that the original number here is negative 88. Everyone good with this? Oh, wait, sorry, did I not flip? Oh, God, sorry. You're right. Okay, forget that. Must be tired. 0, 1, 0, 0. Oh, sorry. So we get 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. Yes, you're absolutely right. Thanks for catching that. You flip the bits, you get 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. You convert that to decimal. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So that gives you 39. And the original one is now negative 39. Thanks a lot. So everyone's good with this. So you subtract 1, flip, get the decimal of this positive number, and just add a negative sign in front of it. Okay, so how does this solve our original problem of duplicate ones? Well, originally we saw that we can go from negative 127 to positive 127. So the new thing we have with 2's complement is that we get one more number, and this number is negative 128. Let me just make sure I have this right. Okay, so negative 128. If we look at the number 128 in the normal decimal representation, I mean normal binary representation, right? If we do the same thing, we get flip the bits, we get 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and then add 1, we get 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. And we have decided, so for this reason, we decided to call this number negative 128. Okay, so this is why we have negative 128. But let's look at 0. Wait, so everyone's following so far? Let's look at 0. So remember how we had the positive 0 and the negative 0 before. But now, if we want to get a negative 0, what do? We flip everything, so we get 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. We add 1 to this number, but then we get 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. There is a overflow, but we don't care about this one. So we get the same 0 again, which means in 2's complement, the positive 0 and the negative 0 are both represented by 8 zeros. So this is why we have the luxury of getting negative 128. So the conclusion is that in 2's complement, you can go from negative 128 to 127. Any questions about 1's complement, 2's complement? How to convert decimals into 1, or how to convert them back into decimals? Is there any other questions about binary or? No? Okay. So I'm going to use the remaining half an hour to talk about scratch blocks. Okay. So let's go over every category and see if we can figure out what each block means. Let's start with control, since we're on this page already. So everyone can see the screen, right? So does everyone know what everything here means? Or actually, does anyone have a request for a category? Like, is there a block in any category that you're not sure what it does? Wait, so no one has any questions about Scratch? Well, okay. Does anyone have any questions about anything else we have seen so far in the course? Well, GCC, if you're on Linux. Borland. Last time I checked, it was. I can look it up and see. You can email me and I can get back to you on that. So my email is, yeah. So this is my name. And my email is yaoyu@fast.com. And I'll get back to you with C compiler information. Dun, 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 dun. Anything else like C, Scratch, programming in general, CS50 in general? I guess Katie did a good job in explaining everything. Well, so I guess you're free to leave. If you have more questions, you can come to me afterwards and